I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. The rakes are stored and the shovels are out here in New Hampshire. But before the snow started to pile up, the lawn keepers among us spent hours raking and bagging leaves to cart off to a transfer station or to leave at the curb for the city to pick up. So what happens to them after they're taken off our hands?
You know, it's cooking a little bit, but it's pretty much done.
On this week's Only in New Hampshire, we're answering a question that came from right inside of our building, our very own Ellen Grimm, senior producer of The Exchange.
My question is, where do all the leaves go? Because we all spend an awful lot of time raking up a lot of leaves, putting them in bags, and setting them out in front of our homes, and then they disappear. And I just wanted to know where they go.
Producer Hannah McCarthy dived into the leaf pile.
However you get rid of your leaves, grass, sticks, and branches, they're all eventually going to end up in the same place, a state of decomposition. But let's start in Manchester, where Ellen lives.
Yard waste collection in Manchester began back in 1993. It actually had been collected previously, but as part of people's trash.
This is Mark Gomez, the guy in charge of environmental programs in the city of Manchester. He says that in 1992, the state passed a law that prohibited the disposal of yard waste in landfills. The primary reason was to save limited space in New Hampshire's dumps for actual garbage. But
There has been another benefit to it in that when yard waste decomposes under anaerobic conditions, like in a landfill, it produces methane gas. And for those concerned about greenhouse gas effects, methane traps about 30 times the amount of heat as carbon dioxide.
But if you take that yard waste out of the mix and put it somewhere else, you can avoid that methane production. So where is it going instead? Well, it starts with Bruce.
Bruce Allen Pacey Jr., truck driver for Pinard.
Bruce works for the independent company contracted to collect yard waste in Manchester. He pilots the collection truck that drives around the city all day.
Yeah, we put in more than 8 hours regularly.
Bruce does garbage collection too.
I don't know. I might not have popular opinion, but I personally prefer trash. I don't know why. I can't really put my finger on it.
Bruce and I sat in the cab while his coworkers, Jake and Tom, jumped on and off, grabbing bags and flinging them into the truck.
Yes, you missed two bags in the opening to that murder.
Yeah, we're going back out. All right. I totally saw them.
Manchester will take a lot off of your hands. Leaves, garden trimmings, branches, and stumps if you cut them to size and bundle them. But Bruce says that there are some things that will gum up the operation.
In the yard waste, no plastic bags is a big one. It doesn't biodegrade, I guess. Anything that's not, you know, leaves, dirt, anything you'd find on the ground in your backyard.
Assuming your leaves and branches do make it into the truck, though, where do they go next?
If you get on 101 East,
yep.
Exit 5, Raymond Chester,
okay.
Take a left,
okay.
Go straight for like 3 or 4 miles, and it's a right dump road, I believe it is,
okay.
Dump road.
Yep.
And there'll be a big sign that says Chester Transfer Station.
I'm Lee Brown. We are in Chester at the compost facility.
You may have actually seen one of these places before. Maybe you've noticed it on the side of the road and weren't sure what you were looking at. Row after row of giant piles of dark soil. These used to be your leaves. And in Chester, they're taken care of by Remy and Sons.
We put them in a pile. We cover them with some compost that's already been here cooking for a while to hold all the bags and everything tight in place so it ain't blowing around. And as the year goes on, we flip the piles, constantly flip them. The more you flip them, the quicker they break down.
We climb into Lee's front-end loader and rumble past piles that look less and less like dirt and more like bags of leaves. Lee digs the truck's massive scoop into a decomposing pile and steam rises into the air.
There's a bacteria, I don't know if I call it bacteria, but it's what breaks down all these leaves.
Okay.
And it has to stay, like I said, a temperature between 120 and 140 in these piles to keep them cooking.
There's actually a lot going on in this compost pile. Bugs and earthworms and fungi and anaerobic bacteria breaking down disparate paper bags full of fall leftovers and turning them into a commodity.
You see right here? Finished product. After all of it's said and done, see how it's still a little warm there? She's still cooking, but it's done. I mean, if you look at it, by spring, the stuff here, beautiful.
This whole process can take a year or more, with Lee turning the piles over 5 or 6 times per year. But with the bacteria doing most of the work, overhead is minimal.
Just me and the machine. Me, the machine, and fuel. That's it.
Once the process is done, Bruce says, the compost is sold to landscaping companies for around $16 a yard. So thanks to the process of decomposition, your leaves eventually turn to gold. It's just not your town's gold. In Manchester, the city pays Pinard Waste, and then Pinard pays the people who compost the yard waste. Mark Gomez with the City of Manchester says this is the one catch to saving all of that landfill space. It's arguably better for the environment, but it's not cheaper for taxpayers.
The downside is that obviously there's a cost to collecting yard waste separately. And when you run the numbers, the additional hit to the City of Manchester budget is about $750,000 per year.
Of course, if you do want to do a little alchemy of your own, you can always try composting in your own backyard. But a word to the wise, make sure you shake up that pile every once in a while.
If it sits and rots, it will get a pungent smell and then people will complain.
What does it smell like?
You want me to take you down and then you can try to explain it?
No, that's okay.
It's pretty nasty sometimes, but like I said...
Hannah, that's really helpful to know for people who actually rake our lawns clean each year. But I've heard some arguments for just leaving all those leaves there.
That's actually a pretty good point. A lot of people think that leaves will smother a yard over the winter, but it turns out that some leaf cover is actually good for your lawn. It fertilizes your grass and builds soil.
Have you just given me a pass to skip the fall yard work? If so, bless you.
Well, there is one caveat. You shouldn't leave your lawn totally covered, especially if there's a chance that a leaf layer could be under a bed of snow all winter, which in New Hampshire is pretty likely, because this can cause something called snow mold, which is this pink or gray fungal disease that attacks your grass and leaves you with spots all over your lawn.
Ooh, I'll admit I'd rather do some work than greet the spring with a lawn full of mold. But I'm hearing a catch-22. I mean, don't rake your leaves, do rake your leaves.
Well, I pulled our very own Sam Evans Brown on this one because he knows a thing or two about the environment. And he says you can just shred all those leaves up with a lawnmower and get the best of both worlds. And of course, he also suggested composting.
Well, thanks so much for the tip, Sam. And thanks, Hannah, for figuring out how leaves become pay dirt.
Anytime.
Now, there are some people for whom raking leaves is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to preparing a yard for winter. And I'm not talking about wrapping your bushes in burlap. A look behind the scenes of an all-consuming holiday hobby coming up after the break on Word of Mouth. Twelve years ago, this video went viral on YouTube. I'll give you a snapshot. Grainy video of a simple two-story home decorated with Christmas lights and synced to the Trans-Siberian Orchestra's Wizards of Winter. It is mesmerizing to watch. Lights blinking in perfect time with a complicated musical arrangement. It was so popular that it made the jump into a Miller Lite commercial in 2005. The comment section of the video praised its originality of the music and the light show that soon launched thousands of imitators. Producer Hannah McCarthy met a holiday lawn impresario here in New Hampshire who says he was already on it.
2005 is when I started animating, and that was the same year that YouTube video went viral.
This is Brian Mitchell, the man behind Mitchell's Magic Christmas in Claremont, New Hampshire.
And I was, I was a year ahead of that, so because that was my first year that year, I was already doing it. But the hobby just started exploding for everybody after that video came out. And everybody was coming, "Oh, you're that house that was on YouTube." And said, "No, it's not me."
Brian's pretty busy this time of year. He's got a full-time job as a grocer in Windsor, Vermont, and his nights are spent monitoring the 50,000 music-synchronized lights that cover his property. The day I caught him on the phone, he was just about to go out Christmas shopping.
You know, about April or May, I'll start looking at starting to dabbling with it again, and if I have any projects in mind, I'll start working on those. So it's a full-year hobby. And then all the programming of the songs, which takes a lot of time.
When Brian says a lot of time, he means hundreds of hours. For every minute of music that he syncs with his lighting display, he spends 10 hours programming with software called Light-O-Rama.
I started animating the display in 2005. At that time, I only had 16 channels. Whenever I came to it, now I have almost 300 channels.
Brian has 26 songs on his playlist, with the whole show clocking in at around 2 hours. That's 1,200 hours of programming, or 1/7 of a year. And so, Brian, you're married, right?
Yes.
So how does your wife feel about all these hours spent working on the display?
Keeps me at home. Keeps me out of trouble. I don't go out to bars. I don't own a boat, you know. It's basically my big hobby.
Brian and his wife, Joyce, bought their home in Claremont back in 1990. One day, about 25 years ago, while Brian was on a tour of extravagant Christmas displays in Manchester, he got inspired.
One guy in particular that had all these moving displays and all motorized and everything. That one was really impressive. So, you know, like, someday I kind of want to do that.
Brian's got a website, ClaremontChristmasLights.com, which he's had since the light animation started. It features photo spreads and a video compilation going back to that inaugural year, 2005. You can watch the shows become more elaborate as Brian adds channels and lights and new songs to the repertoire. Elsewhere on the site, you'll find driving directions to the Mitchells' home. They end in the instruction, follow the glow. It's not unusual to find drivers idling in their cars, ogling the displays when you pull up to the Mitchell house. A green glowing sign planted in the front yard invites people to listen to the lights by tuning to a short-range radio signal broadcast from Brian's basement. Though if you're close enough, you'll catch the music coming from speakers in the yard. Visitors slowly emerge from their cars and drift across the street, some surprised to find that the Mitchell display is a walkthrough, leading people to a backyard scene of these painted wooden cutouts and light-up penguins and angels and Santas and reindeer, all arranged according to a different theme every year.
Hey, we've never been here before. This is great, yeah. My wife heard about it, so we're like, oh, we should go check it out. And I grew up not far from here, so I was like, I've never heard of it. Why have I never heard of it? So we drove down and, you know, we put it on the GPS. It was like, take a left, take a right, take a left. She's 2.5, so she can't stop staring at it, you know, and sees Olaf over there. And
meanwhile, out front, the feature-length light show takes up every spare surface, with a 2D Christmas tree assuming the occasional speaking role and stars and flash bulbs bursting like tiny fireworks in the trees.
Wow, that's dedication, that is great.
With your phones, you think to yourself that you could just press, like I have a Bluetooth light that I can sync the audio to and it just like flashes on and off, so that's what I thought it was, but to think that he spent 10 hours, holy smokes.
Being such a big production, Brian Mitchell's display does need regular upkeep. So if you stick around long enough, there's a chance the creator himself will appear.
Well, I'm looking at this, which is froze up.
Oh,
it's
I see that, yeah.
It's supposed to turn more, so I was just about to go and fix that.
Brian is tall, he wears glasses, he was in jeans and a blue fleece when I met him. You might think he's just another visitor to the yard until he reaches into the display to straighten a fallen blow-up penguin or inspect the abominable snowman.
We hang out until the traffic slows down, usually. Sometimes it's 8 o'clock. Sometimes, like on weekends, it doesn't let up until the lights go off.
Brian says the display creates its own little community, with people who came as kids bringing their own children to see how the lights have changed. There's been at least one marriage proposal in the backyard. And then there's the community of people like Brian.
There's several of them that I'm in. One is, two of them on the internet, you know, 20,000 members in it now.
Do you guys trade insider tips?
We trade everything. Everybody helps everybody. You know, anyone that's having problems, you know, 10, 15 people will jump right in and offer solutions.
Like any other hobby, Brian says, this one costs him money. Fishermen have their reels. He has his lights. But the operating cost, he says, is only about $8 a day. In the early days, people offered him donations for the show, but he said he didn't want other people paying for his own hobby. So instead, he put out a donation box for David's House, which provides housing for families of children in treatment at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. They raise about $2,000 a year. The only real catch is that Brian really loves checking out other great displays. And these days...
I don't have much of a chance to anymore. I would love to, but we're pretty much glued here every night.
Though, it does mean that he has a chance to work on his YouTube videos. Brian says they haven't gone viral yet, but he is working on it.
Yeah, they're better now. I got a GoPro. So I got a GoPro last year for Christmas, and so it's improved my videos.
So, Virginia, do you want to see one of these videos?
Of course, let's see
okay,
it.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, my word. Oh, my word. It's like Graceland.
Yeah.
Wow. There are like rainbows of light, animated. Oh, my God. And now a Christmas tree is singing.
Oh, yeah.
This is amazing. Amazing. Got to hand it to Mitchell.
I know, you really do.
But it looks like a ton of work. If somebody wanted to get into this hobby, what would that take?
Well, so those 1,200 hours of programming aside, Brian told me that he starts pulling out the decorations on October 15th, and then he lights up on Black Friday. And somewhere in there, he takes a week-long vacation just to work on the display.
So that's like 6 weeks of decorating, not to mention however long it took to buy all the decorations.
And Brian makes a ton of those himself. He's even got this thing that he calls a naughty or nice machine. You press this big red button and wait while the machine decides basically where on Santa's list you fall.
So funny. A pretty major commitment, though. Does it pay off for him? I mean, aside from spreading holiday cheer.
Well, Brian chooses to have donations sent to David's House, but a lot of people do enter contests in this field. So I know that that Light-O-Rama company that Brian uses to help program, it has a contest every year that's got some pretty tech-specific entry guidelines. And then if you're really good, apparently there's this show called The Great Christmas Light Fight, and the prize on that one is $50,000.
Well, that's great American innovation, turning Christmas decorations into a full-blown competitive sport.
Yeah, I dare say Santa would be proud.
Thanks so much for listening to the lights.
I consider it my elfly duty, Virginia.
Definitely the nice elf. Word of Mouth was produced this week by Hannah McCarthy with help from Taylor Quimby, Jimmy Gutierrez, Ben Henry, and Justine Paradise. Maureen McMurray is director of that super tangled string of lights that gives you trouble every year. You can check out videos and photos of the Mitchells masterpiece at wordofmouthradio.org. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions. Next week on Word of Mouth, we'll hear from the passionate and motley crews who helped to build New Hampshire's local food scene and check in with an often ignored segment of the state's art scene, plus an intimate conversation with the National Book Award winner, Frank Bidart. I'll sit down and speak with the poet who has been changing the game for 5 decades since he first burst onto the scene in the 1960s with a poem that explored the inner life of a murderous, obsessive psychopath.
Nothing human is alien to me. I wanted to begin my first book at the bottom with like the dark substrata of the human stuff.
More of that human stuff on Word of Mouth next Saturday at 11. Stay with us for the 10-Minute Writers Workshop followed by Civics 101. This is NHPR.